Welcome to the It's All Journalism podcast. I'm Julie O'Donohue, here with fellow producer Michael O'Connell. Our guest today is Slate editor David Plotz. David started off at Slate as a staff writer in 1996 and took over as the lead editor in 2008. He's written two books and previously worked for the Washington City Paper. You can hear David weekly on the Slate Political Gab Fest, which comes out every Friday. Welcome, David.
Thank you.
So can you tell us a little bit, I mean, from what I read, you initially came out of college being interested in being a lawyer? And can you talk a little bit about your history?
Sure. When I came out of college, it was 1992, and the journalism market was down, but I wasn't really thinking about journalism. And instead, I thought I was going to be a lawyer or work in public policy. And so I went to work as a paralegal at the Justice Department, figuring I would learn what lawyers did there. And I did, and it was dismal. It was really depressing. I was there about a day, and I realized I do not want to do this. These are people who are unhappy. And I thought I would actually be good at it, which is what was even more – it was the right decision, because a lot of people end up sort of falling into law school. And I, this year, working at the Justice Department doing paralegal work really persuaded me that while law was a profession that rewarded the kind of mind I have, it was not going to be right for me. So I sent out 93 letters to newspapers around the country, got – one response from the Winston-Salem newspaper, and then one response from the Washington City Paper. And Jack Schaefer, who was then the editor of the City Paper, hired me basically solely on the foundation of my senior thesis in college, which had been about Marion Barry. So he liked that. And so I ended up falling into journalism because of Marion Barry, basically.
Did you get to update that once Marion Barry came back?
I did. The first story I wrote for City Paper was about Marion Barry's comeback, which was then even nascent. That was his first
comeback.
That was the comeback where he ran for city council, and then a couple of years later he ran for mayor again, and then
I think everybody who covers
coming back forever.
I think everybody who covers the city in Washington D.C. has an evergreen Marion Barry story in their file somewhere to update.
Right.
As
it was amazing. I barely ever talked to him. What was funny is I wrote a huge amount about him, but never really spoke to him. I talked to a lot of people around him, but he didn't. He wanted nothing to do with me as a
fascinating.
Then I think now probably he would have been glad for the attention now.
So what was it that appealed to you about going into journalism?
Well, I'd done it in college and in high school for that matter. And in college I'd liked it, and I'm omnivorous. I'm unable to concentrate on any one subject for any long period of time, and I'm easily bored, and I like asking people questions, and I was so it seemed like a good fit, and it has been. I've loved it. It's been a great profession.
Mm-hmm. So in 1996, when Slate started, there weren't that many online-only publications. I'm kind of curious about why, I mean, presumably you left the City Paper to go to Slate, and what your thought process was at that time.
Well, I loved being at the City Paper, and I worked for two incredible editors, Jack Schaefer, who was then succeeded by David Carr, now of the New York Times.
Oh, wow. You overlapped.
Yeah.
Well,
I overlapped with them. And I was David's deputy. And there was just the City Paper, the talent that was there, it's incredible. Clara Jeffrey, who's now editor of Mother Jones, another person who worked with me, and the list of people who Eric Wemple was.
Sure, yeah.
I hired Eric Wemple. I hired Mike Schaefer, who then became editor of City Paper. So when I heard that this online magazine was starting, I literally had not been on the web when I got my job at Slate. It was something, nobody was on the web in 1996. There was not very much stuff.
You mean you had never gone on the web?
I had never gone on the web. In 1990, it's after I got hired. Between the time I got hired and started work, I had someone at the City Paper office show me the web. But I had used email, but there was no, we were doing things digitally, but there was just using the web was not something people did as an everyday matter much in 1996.
Some of our listeners might be younger. I mean, there was really no Google, so you were.
There was hardly anything.
You go to AOL and that add groups and things.
Right.
That's pretty much it.
Right. You chatted.
You chatted. And so, but I wish I could say I was prescient or that I really knew what I was doing, but I felt first of all, Michael Kinsley, who founded Slate, was a journalistic hero of mine. It appeared to me that this was a new medium, and it was an exciting new medium. And so I thought, why not? I might as well give it a shot. I didn't want to go work for a big newspaper. Even then, big newspapers felt troubled. And, if the New Yorker had come along and offered me a job, I probably would have taken that instead. But New Yorker wasn't coming knocking. So Slate was a great option. It was an incredible place to be because having started there in 1996 in a quite junior position and then stayed there forever since then, it's really given me the chance to see almost every iteration of digital journalism. You know, Slate has tried everything, done lots and lots of different things. And what I think is remarkable about Slate is, you know, having lasted that time, you know, we started with some thousands of readers and now have tens of millions of readers, or, you know, 15 million readers, is that while the medium has changed and while how we go about doing our business has changed and while all the different formats have changed, the basic DNA of what Slate is has not changed at all, which is that it's skeptical, it's funny, it's analytical, counterintuitive. All those things were there from the first day, and they're there today.
And do you think it's that combination of things that have sort of given you your longevity and built your audience?
That have given Slate its longevity? Yeah. Well, I think that a commitment that we've always known what we were good at. That's not to say we haven't been swayed in directions that were mistakes. We certainly have. We've tried things that didn't work. But we've basically always known what we were good at. And so there hasn't been a lot of messing around with disastrous forays into sleazy celebrity journalism or things that we just wouldn't work. So the voice has been consistent. So that's important. And, you know, why else? We had backers. We had first in Microsoft, which owned Slate originally, and now in the Washington Post Company, soon to be renamed Washington Post Company, the Graham Company or whatever it's called. Backers that were willing to finance a site that did not make money. Mm-hmm. And now we're – this year will be profitable, I would expect, will be profitable. And that's a long time to go without making money. So part of it is just owners that were willing to fund and experiment in journalism for quite a long time.
Is this the first year ever you're going to be profitable?
Well, we're not actually not allowed to report that.
Okay.
But we're doing really well.
Okay.
Put it that way.
Okay.
It's our best year ever.
Actually, I want to talk about that. So it seems like your traffic is way up from what I've read. My understanding is you guys switched sort of to looking more at data and sort of analyzing it and trying to figure out how to drive traffic to your site, if I'm not characterizing things right.
Well, so if the thing that has been consistent about Slate has been, as I said, this editorial voice. And if you look, you know, we have many of the same writers working for us now as worked for us in 1996 or in 2000. So the kind of writerly voice and the sense about what we're doing has changed, as it hasn't changed. What has changed is the way we go about it. So as you say, we've really upped our use of data. We have an incredibly strong tech team now, which hasn't historically been true. Right now we have a very strong tech team, and they're great with data. And so we've used that to understand what makes the site work. And so one insight that we've had, which is not an insight of genius, anybody will tell you this, is that you can't get more readers unless you publish more. So if you look at Slate publishes twice as much content as we did about a year ago, and maybe 18 months ago. And the result is that we have twice the audience. So you can't expect, barring some crazy miracle, you can't expect to get a bigger audience unless you give readers more stuff to read. And that they will find there'll be more. You'll just have more hits. You won't even know what the hits are going to be, but you're going to have more hits if you place more bets. And so that is something that the data has shown us. We have looked at the data to see what kinds of stories our readers read. Are they reading
outside of Dear Prudence?
Which I read
within 5 minutes.
Yes, and that's certainly is our most popular regular feature. But they also it's not the only thing they read. I mean, we for example, about a year ago, I hired a new science editor named Laura Helmuth, great editor, and we were talking, and we realized we hired her because we thought, well, science content does well for us. And I asked her to look around. Is there something we should do that we're not doing that would help us pick up traffic? And she said, you know, there's this really great astronomy blogger who has a blog which is about astronomy and also about climate change and about science skepticism and various other subjects like that. And you know, I don't think he's – Laura said, I don't think he's read by enough people. He was at Discover magazine at the time. His name is Phil Plait. The blog is called Bad Astronomy. And she said, well, why don't we go get him? And so we went and hired Phil. And who would have thought in 2011, who would have – if you'd said, should Slate have an astronomy blog? I would have been like, well, why should Slate have an astronomy blog? It doesn't make sense. But we've started it and we picked it up. It's our most popular blog most months. It has – a couple months ago, it had 2 million unique readers, just that blog alone. Consistently more than 1 million unique readers in that blog. Those are 1 million new people who've come to Slate because we're suddenly covering this subject, which they love. Now, because we're not a news site in the strict sense, we don't have obligatory daily news coverage.
Sure.
We cover kind of what we want. We have to be around the news, but we don't have to have a story about every little thing that happens in the news. It gives us a license to cover that which we are interested in, which is something that is unusual. I mean, I think to take this in a slightly different direction, if you look at successful digital properties these days, they tend to fall into two areas, and we're kind of in a third. One area is subject matter expertise, where you own a particular subject. You know, Politico is a great example of that, or All Things D, or then there are massive kinds of general interest aggregators, HuffPo being par excellence, you know, but also places, you know, Business Insider I would put in that category. Forbes is a little bit that way, where there's just so much stuff there and they have everything. Slate is a third model, which is that we're not defined by subject matter. We're not defined by comprehensiveness. We're defined by sensibility. And the sensibility is like a place where people want to go to feel smart and to feel like they're surrounded by other smart, fun, skeptical people.
Yeah.
And that's kind of our sweet spot.
Yeah. I mean, I'm really into – I mean, I listen to most of your podcasts, but I love the Hang Up and Listen podcast because I feel like Slate's sports coverage, mostly, which I consume through that podcast, is just done a lot more smartly. I mean, maybe I feel smarter when I'm listening to it. I don't know, than a lot of other things I listen to, even podcasts that sort of are favored in that kind of genre.
Well, I agree. Thank you.
Yeah.
It's sort of interesting because sort of what you're describing is maybe even the way that the magazines used to be, that you would, you know, like a GQ magazine, that you would sort of define who your audience is and you're speaking specifically to that audience, as opposed to the models you were describing before, which are the generalist, you know, the HuffPost type thing, or somebody who's it's just subject matter. It's just sort of an interesting, you know, way that I've never really sort of thought about.
Well, we are very much, and it's very rare to find a digital property which defines itself as a magazine, but we really do. There are not many places like that. I mean, Salon still does.
I was like, except for Salon.
Right. But I think that is what we're much more like the New Yorker or the Atlantic than we're like HuffPo.
Hmm. It's interesting because you wonder if somebody who's a HuffPo reader would define themselves as a HuffPo reader, or they just go there to get the news, or they click on headlines that they think are kind of interesting or stuff.
But I do think people who go to Slate define themselves as Slate readers.
Well, some of them do. Yeah. I think every publication has a series of concentric circles. So you start with this large circle on the outside, which is the people who hit your site. They're probably not even aware they're at Slate.
How did I get here?
They don't even know what Slate is. They just have been referred by Facebook or something, you know, by the dark internet to a Slate article, and they hit it once, they read it, they don't ever come back, they don't identify with it. The second, then within that, there's a smaller concentric circle of people who, you know they're at Slate, but don't make a habit of it. And then there's a third well, I mean, maybe even a third and a fourth, but the third is kind of your core audience. Those are the people who are there, who come to you, who love you, who know you. And that third one, you kind of optimize for. You want them. You have to grow that bigger circle. But really, the little circle is the people who know you and love you and want you. And that is always a small fraction of your total audience. But you can't make that number bigger unless you make the biggest circle bigger. So what we've discovered is that we've always had this kind of core, hardcore Slate audience. We measure the people who visit us 25 times a month. That's always been there. And we thought, okay, well, that's our core audience, and like that's sort of what we have. But then as we grew the bigger audience, that core audience suddenly doubled. So when we doubled our big audience, our core audience doubled. It's just like, you know, you turn some of those occasional visitors into regular Slate people. Mm-hmm. And so even though Slate is sort of it's a club, it is sensibility, and not everyone wants it. There are a lot more people out there who would want it if they knew more about it. So mm-hmm. we keep building the audience, which is good.
How do you serve that audience, that core audience? What is it how do you keep the content interesting and different? And are you sort of constantly sort of experimenting, or is it just you in yourself, you sort of defined what that person is going to want to read about, that then you go out and you find that?
Again, I mean, this, I feel like I'm just sitting here like, Slate is so great. We're so great. But, well, but
tell
that's
us
what,
what's
that's
bad
what,
about
no, that's what I'm going to do for a moment, and then I'll tell you what's bad about us. The sensibility of Slate has always been very experimental. So we've always tried to do things differently on the grounds that, one, a lot of people are easily bored, and two, you won't know what's successful unless you try new things. So we were the first site – we were literally the first site to do aggregation. In fact, I would say I was the first aggregator in America, because I wrote a feature for Slate back in 1996, which was called In Other Magazines, which aggregated what was in other magazines. We had the first political blog.
You were early adopters of podcasts.
We were very early adopters of podcasts.
I read an article that said that – is it Andy Bowers used to just read Slate articles?
We used to read Slate articles. Yeah. People liked it. People dug that. And
they listen to them as they go to bed.
Yeah. So we've always been – we have been trying to experiment, and we think that holds loyal readers. But in particular, I think the things that have worked – to keep a core audience, podcasts have been crucial for us. A lot of places don't do them. I don't understand it. There is nothing that builds loyalty and commitment more than a kind of podcast audience. Those people are devoted. You can build a podcast that people like. They will come. They love it. It's crazy how much people love our podcasts. Now, it's not a huge audience. We don't have a podcast audience of the size of a This American Life or a Radio Lab. So I wish it were bigger. But the audience, the 100,000 people who listen to the Political Gabfest every week are 100,000 crazily devoted listeners.
Mm-hmm.
So serving them with podcasts, serving them with live events. We've done more and more live events is something else we do. And then it's more just like hiring smart writers. You hire Matt Iglesias, Dave Weigel, Dahlia Lithwick, Emily Bazelon, and people want to read them.
So can we talk a little bit about the headlines at Slate? So when I talk to people about Slate, I heard like a lot of everything from like, can you ask them about their headlines being clickbait or provocative? And like the most popular article on Slate today, well, I just checked like an hour ago, was if you send your kid to private school, you are a bad person, which
is
for sure something I clicked on,
right,
by the way.
Yeah.
I guess, like, I want to hear a little bit about how you guys come up with your headlines. Do the writers come up with them? What's the process?
What's
there?
The rationale behind?
Well, headlines have always been very important to Slate. We've always devoted a lot of energy to them. I actually think that we're in a golden age of headline writing, that the internet demands it, basically because that's the chance you get.
Right.
So if you look at, like, Upworthy, I don't know if you guys look at Upworthy, but Upworthy.
Yeah.
Upworthy headlines are just incredibly good.
Yeah.
And not in the – I mean, BuzzFeed headlines are good, but BuzzFeed headlines are good in a very formulaic way. Upworthy headlines are good in a just inspired way.
You're like, I don't want to click, but I am.
I have to resist. I have to literally resist clicking on the Upworthy headlines. We have a partnership. I love those guys. I think they're incredible. I think we try to avoid very strongly – promising things that are not in the story. So that story about if you send your kid to private school, you're a bad person. The first line of that piece is, if you send your kid to private school, you're a bad person. And then goes on to make the case that if you send your kid to private school, you're a bad person.
Oh, absolutely.
I would argue that that if you have a problem with that story, the problem is not the headline. The problem is the story. Like the content of that story is, you could argue it's trolling.
Sure.
Like that Allison was trolling there. She firmly believes that. She like is passionate about it. But, you know, we certainly – there are 5,000 comments on the Slate site that say you are trolling with this. So, but I don't think the headline is the flaw. I think that's a you argue with that story.
It's the most true headline to that story.
Exactly.
No, it absolutely is true of the story. I have to say that. I read the article and it.
We're not lying.
There's a Twitter hashtag called Slate Pitches. This idea, which is just the counterintuitive story of Slate will write, like, you know. We should give Bashir Assad the Nobel Peace Prize, like things like that. This would be, you know, that's an extreme Slate pitch. But there's lots of, you know, Creed is the best band of the 1990s, things like that. And there's a tension within Slate, like how Slate pitchy. In fact, we say that Slate pitchy. How Slate pitchy should we be? And we're in a kind of existential argument with ourselves about that.
So I know this sounds really nerdy for journalism, but I'm actually interested in the process of the headline. Does the writer pitch the headline?
So it varies. Mostly our writers our bloggers write their own headlines. But like a writer who's doing a story will sometimes write a headline. So Allison, I edited that piece, and that was the story. That was the headline that Allison sent to me. Or okay. I think I changed it slightly. I may have tweaked it. But basically that was the headline. But Allison's also an editor. But we have every day there's a headline call where three of the top editors of the magazine write the headlines for our covers. Hmm. And we're very proud of that. And that's not necessarily article headlines. Those are the headlines that appear on our homepage. But we probably spend more time on that than we should. That really just some clear, provocative headline writing is more important than – it used to be you would try for a great pun or something. Now it's really just like say it straight.
I hesitate to bring this in, but because this is we're talking about headlines, SEO. I mean, from what you're saying about your headlines, I wouldn't necessarily think that would be an SEO sort of consideration. That you're more interested in, you know, not so much buzzwords, but you're trying to create whatever your voice is.
Right. So we are much less search oriented than a lot of places. So if you look at,
yeah, I'm not necessarily a huge advocate saying that we should write all our headlines by SEO. I'm
right.
Just saying.
We practice basic SEO hygiene. So we have a person who every new hire gets a tutorial on how to write headlines, make sure you know how to do promo lines, how to do keywords, so that the SEO is good. But the percentage of traffic that we get off search is relatively low, I think, compared to a lot of our competitors. We really are looking for social more than we are looking for search. So we care a lot about how we do on Twitter and a lot how we do on Facebook and Reddit and Dig. And those are places where, while actually in total mass of traffic, search still outweighs Facebook and Twitter. The growth for us is really in Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah, because I can imagine with a provocative headline, you're going to, you know, somebody sharing is going to want to share that more on Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah, I mean, everyone is about virality and not – the virality is completely surpassed search. That search is – I mean, I'm sure there are places where search really matters. Like if you're – the Washington Post, I know, does quite well in search. But for us, we're never – we rarely own search terms.
So you guys weren't part of the Bezos sale. Yeah, I know you guys are under
correct,
the Washington
right.
Post company. What does that mean for you moving forward? Because I know you share some content with the Post, mm-hmm. and I'm curious about whether that affects you.
Well, it's a huge deal, and it's obviously very sad for our owners. I mean, I think anyone who's had the pleasure of knowing Don Graham and knowing the top executives at the Post know that they are just as good a set of people as you will find. And Don has said, and I believe it, that this was a very painful decision, and you know, it takes the heart of this company away. I mean, you can say, oh, Kaplan is worth more, and oh, the TV stations that the company owns are worth a ton of money, and they're really – but no, the heart has always been the Washington Post newspaper. And so, you know, we have to have a new name for our company. I don't know what the name of my company is anymore. It's not the Washington Post anymore. So
Slate Co.
Well, you know, we suggested that. I don't think that's going to happen. The effect on us is limited. Every sign, everything that we have heard, and I believe the people who talk to us about it, everything we've heard is that they want, like us, are happy with us, want us to continue operating the same way we have. Our connections with the newspaper, I've talked to Marty Baron a little bit about this. We have various kinds of editorial partnerships with them, and they're going to continue for the moment. There's no reason to shift them. They send us a certain amount of traffic in exchange for some content that we give them. There's some things we share. There's some features that we share. And that will continue. The really difficult part is like really technical things, like our lawyers actually work for the Washington Post company. We're at Washington Post newspaper, and so we no longer have a lawyer, so we need to get a new lawyer. I spent much of my day dealing with that. Our accounts payable are handled by the accountants at the Washington Post company. We have to find a new accounts payable. That's technical stuff that's really tedious and a huge pain, but not is not interesting.
But pretty important.
But incredibly. It's incredibly important, yeah.
We want you to be without a lawyer.
So now Slate at one point had a paywall and that went up and then it went down. What was sort of your experience with that?
So we had a paywall incredibly early. So we had a paywall from early 1998 to early 1999.
Wow.
About a year after we launched, we put a paywall up. It was always the intention of Kinsley, the original editor, to have a paywall. And it took about a year for us to get it built, and we put it up, and it was horrible. It was a disaster. Traffic dropped. I think we allowed that day's content was visible, but everything besides that day's content was behind the paywall. Traffic dropped precipitously.
Not surprisingly.
And the amount of revenue was marginal, and that we lost ad revenue, such as it was back in those days. And the real damage, so we dropped it after a year, but the real damage is that 12 years later, you know, even this week, there are still people who will say to me, oh, Slate, I would read that, but I don't want to have to pay. I'm like, You don't have to pay. You haven't had to pay for 12 years. But it got stuck in people's heads, like, because we were one of the few places that did a subscription. Oh, this is a site you have to pay for. And that really damaged our reputation. And as a result, we're very leery of subscriptions. I don't think that a place like Slate can have a subscription, because we're a pleasure read. We are not an obligation. You tend to subscribe to things that you feel obliged to read. And we are just not that. We're something people read for pleasure. And we bring a huge amount of pleasure. And there are certain things I think that people would pay for. But the economics of it don't make sense. That said, we will almost certainly adopt a kind of membership model, which is different, which is voluntary. There's nothing that is currently – nothing that you get now on Slate will you stop getting. But we will offer, you know, some bonus video content. Like if we're going to do a live GabFest in Washington, if you're a member, it'll be free. I didn't promise that. Listeners, I didn't just say that. That's a hypothetical. We would special access to, you know, maybe Slate editorial meetings, things sort of behind the scenes, things that members who really are kind of keen on us can can join.
Sort of premium content.
There'll be content. It will be less content like, oh, we're not going to have special stories that are available to members. It'll be more like how did we get
extras.
That story? Extras, like, and behind the scenes stuff. I mean, I think the people who are likely to subscribe are people who mostly, I think, they're podcast listeners. They're people who already have a kind of cathected, familial relationship with us and want to deepen that. They want to take it to the next level with us.
So is it a little bit like I'm a member of the Texas Tribune, which doesn't mean I get any extra content, but I get some extra – I don't live in Texas, so I don't get some extra, but I get like – I don't know, sometimes they send me a bag or I get a discount on their event.
Yeah, it might be like that.
Yeah.
Discounts on cowboy boots and things like that.
Well, on their events, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So, that sounds cool.
I mean, Slate had its time in a paywall. I mean, do you think that the conversations that the publications are still having about paywalls, do you think those are still worth having?
Because there are places that are having some success with it. There are places that can do it. I think many more places are trying it than can get away with it. So mm-hmm. The New York Times has basically been able to succeed with it. That's basically worked because The New York Times, you have to read it. And the FT and the Wall Street Journal, Financial Times and the Wall Street Journal have also tried that and basically succeeded because, again, they have this kind of obligation, Consumer Reports obligation. You know, it's such a high utility. There's sports sites that can do it and they have something that people need. Fantasy, you know, if you have fantasy football kinds of stuff, that's against the stuff that people will pay for. There are lots of places that are trying these paywalls. They're trying these like, you know, you get 20 articles and then you have to pay. And that seems sort of like a freebie to people, but I think it damages you. I don't think you can get away with walling people off unless you are really special. I mean, the Washington Post is actually a really good test case. I am very skeptical of that paywall.
Yeah. Yeah, as am I. It'll be really interesting. They're, you know, got to give them credit for trying something, but I don't know if paywall was the right choice to make. I mean, they've got so many issues of the fact that they've got so many people. Their website draws so many more people from outside the area that their print reader. Well, they've got to deal with a print readership still and support that locally.
Feel like it's a Netflix, Amazon Prime situation. Like, if I'm going to pay for one, I'll pay for Netflix. If I'm going to pay for one, I'll pay for the New York Times. And that's coming from someone who grew up here. And I, you know,
yeah.
I mean, that's not saying I don't visit the Post, but like, I'm less willing. There's only so many things that I can be paying for online, right. And it's right. just not. I think I at this point am more willing to pay for the New York Times than I am the Post.
Let's talk a little bit about your podcast, your political podcast. Mm-hmm. What do you enjoy doing about that?
Well, we started the podcast a long time ago. We just discovered our first episode in the archives. It was from 2005, so it's been almost 8 years. It was late 2005, and that's a long time to be doing a podcast. What I think carries us is a couple of things. So the podcast, for those of you who don't know, is it's a political talk show between me, among me, our chief political correspondent, John Dickerson, and our senior editor, Emily Bazelon. And we talk about main issues in politics that week. We just taped it a few minutes ago, in fact. And the premise is that this is the kind of conversation that happens in the bar after the show. Like, it was much more casual. It's always been much more casual than a lot of shows. And in the early days of podcasting, it was particularly so. We've gotten actually more formal as time has gone on because we now produce it for the radio too. So we have to sometimes hit time markers, and it just, like, there's a certain professionalism that has crept in over our best
Dad.
Intentions. But I think what motivates us is, one, we're friends. So the three of us who do the show, John, Emily, and I are friends. We've always been friends, and the chemistry among us is genuine and real, and like we get on, and we like spending time together. We like doing it. We would probably do it if no one listened. The other thing is that we suddenly, maybe 5 years ago, we decided to do a live show. We decided to do a live show around the first Barack Obama inauguration. We did it at 6th and I. We were just like, we didn't know what was going to happen. We just decided to try it. No mm-hmm. one did. No one did podcast live shows at that point. And basically, the whole universe wanted to come. There were 1,500 people signed up to go to this live show. And we were like, what?
What?
And
now it's suddenly work and responsibility.
Well, no. And we realized people are listening. People care. They are attached to us. And it's great. It's like the readers, listeners, I should say, love the show. They let us, you know, they are harsh on us. They let us know how they feel. They tweeted us. They send us things. They, you know, they stop me on the street. I get stopped on the street all the time because people hear me talking and they're like, off your show, or why did you say that about Emily, or stop giving John such a hard time. So it's very rewarding psychically.
Yeah, I don't know why podcasting isn't adopted in a much wider way than it is. At least it seems to me in the public consciousness, it's still kind of, you know, I don't know what you want to call it, sort of a quirky, odd right. sort of thing. It's not in and of itself recognized as a medium that has sort of strength to it. And it does have a lot of strength. It's for the reasons you say. People are loyal. They're hanging on your words. They want to, you know, see what you're going to say next, or see what topic that you're going to jump on next.
Although I would say one of the nice things about the political Gabfest, but also other Slate podcasts, is that you guys are friends, but you like don't agree on everything. I mean, there are some podcasts where everyone is in agreement, right. and then it's like the conversation right. is pretty stale.
Problem right. solved.
Right, we try to have the turd in the punch bowl. Like, it helps a lot. So much of the, I think, the reason why podcasting works is, I mean, you're in people's head,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And they
right.
really feel, in a way they don't with video, that they're part of this conversation. We had this amazing moment. Like a year ago, I was sitting in my office. We posted the show late because Dickerson was on the road for the campaign or something. We just couldn't get around to posting the show on time. So we posted the show late. It usually goes up on Thursday night. Instead, it went up on Friday at noon or something. On Friday afternoon, I'm in my office and I get this phone call, and I pick a phone and it's like, "This is Stephen Colbert. I'm calling to complain because you ruined my Friday. You posted the show late." And I was like, "What? This is not Stephen Colbert." And of course, it was Stephen Colbert, and he was calling because literally his Friday morning ritual is to listen to the show, and he was furious that we had messed with it. And we had a nice conversation. And so we did our last New York Live show. Stephen came and did a special like guest appearance, and he talked about – he kind of did a great cameo, surprise cameo. But he talked about his sense of being the guest at the dinner party with us.
Right.
Like, and that's what people feel, is that they're at a – they're at a dinner party.
It's really the conversation. I mean, there a few years ago when people were all talking about, oh, everybody's going to be in their iPods, everybody's going to be focused on their screens and their phones, and they're not, you know, people are going to be tweeting each other. They're not going to be conversing. But you know, podcasting is built on minds reaching out and communicating with each other. And I think people just so naturally, you know, it's a human thing that we connect to that. And I think it's really powerful, and that's the surprising thing about me. When I got into podcasts, and before doing this, it was just like, you know, you sit in the car and you just get so involved. And you know, before talk radio became really, you know, stringent, and you know, everything was politicized, and it was right versus left. You know, that was sort of lost. That element was lost. But I think podcasting sort of brings that back.
Yeah.
Yes, we're gonna
wrap up. Jinx.
Jinx.
Thank you so much for coming in and talking to us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Okay.
All right.
You've been listening to It's All Journalism, a weekly podcast about the changing state of media.
You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or find out more information about It's All Journalism at itsalljournalism.com.
We'd like to hear what you have to say. If you have topics that you'd like us to cover or suggestions about who to interview, email us at editor@itsalljournalism.com.
Also look for It's All Journalism on Facebook and follow us on Twitter @alljournalism.